Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, Halloween begins a string of holidays into the new year. But in a pandemic, can we celebrate safely? Plus, how are political campaigns connecting to Latinx voters in the Valley? But first, we're going to turn to one of the state's more complicated propositions, one that deals with the issue of kidney dialysis. If you've taken the time to read it, you know how confusing Prop 23 is. It requires dialysis clinics to have a doctor on site at all times. But there's more to it than that. Here to help us interpret the proposition is our colleague at KQED, April Domboski.
Looking back now, Dwayne Cox says his path to kidney failure started in childhood. He lives in L.A. now, but he grew up on the south side of Chicago.
In the projects, mostly. So I fought off gangs. I also had two parents that were both heroin addicts. So there was lots of stress and a poor diet.
His dad left when he was 14.
I was the man of the house very, very early.
And he was diagnosed with high blood pressure when he was 16. He managed it with medications, but they made him tired and he had to pee all the time. That really became a problem in his 40s when he got a field job with the Obama campaign.
It meant that I had to keep up with all these college students.
So for 3 months, he stopped taking his medications.
And I had to keep up.
Even now, he says he would do it again. But it was a turning point in his health. In 2009, his doctor told him he had kidney failure and he would have to start dialysis.
I actually, like most people, didn't even know what my kidneys were, where they were, or what they did.
African Americans, like Cox, are almost four times more likely to end up with kidney failure than whites. This is because of genetic and socioeconomic factors that make African Americans more likely to develop high blood pressure or diabetes, the main diseases that cause kidney failure. And Black people are less likely to have access to regular health care to prevent it. But once you have kidney failure, it's different. The U.S. government pays for dialysis for anyone who needs it. Here's how John Oliver puts it.
Essentially, we have universal health care in this country for one organ in the body. It's like your kidneys and only your kidneys are Canadian.
Across the U.S., nearly 500,000 patients get hooked up to dialysis machines 3 times a week for 3 to 4 hours each time. The vast majority of these dialysis clinics are owned by just two companies, DaVita and Fresenius. Together, they earned $2 billion in profits last year. Dialysis nurse Magellan Hanford says it's a business built on the backs of people of color.
I grew up in South Central LA, and when I was growing up, there was a liquor store on every corner.
And now?
There's a dialysis clinic on every corner in LA.
Hanford says those clinics don't invest enough of their profits into care.
Patients dripping blood all over the place, mice in clinics, roaches in clinics. Technicians taking shortcuts.
He says nurses don't have enough time between patients to follow proper infection control protocols.
The industry is built on numbers. We need to get patients in and we need to get patients out.
This is why Hanford has been trying to help unionize staff so they can have more say in clinic operations. But they haven't succeeded. That's where Prop 23 comes in.
Doing propositions are the only voice that we have as workers.
But here's the thing. Prop 23 requiring clinics to have doctors on site at all times, this won't fix Hanford's complaints. In fact, there's little evidence that it will improve patient health at all. Medicare tested this for more than a decade. It incentivized doctors to visit their dialysis patients more often, 4 times a month instead of 1 or 2. Then they studied which patients did better.
Guess what? Doesn't matter.
Indiana University nephrologist Jay Wish says health outcomes were the same.
It doesn't affect outcomes.
In fact, patients who were seen less often by their doctors actually had better survival rates. Here's the other thing about Prop 23. The doctor on site, it can be any kind of doctor. One who doesn't know a thing about dialysis.
That's even more dangerous than having nobody there.
This is why patient Dwayne Cox is against Prop 23. He says the union that's backing the measure is just using the ballot box to gain leverage in its own labor disputes.
It makes me angry because they're playing politics, but they're putting patients like me in the middle of it.
It bothers him that voters are being asked to decide what's best for his health. In Oakland, I'm April Dymbosky.
You're listening to Valley Edition. 25 years ago, California voters banned affirmative action. Now voters will decide on Proposition 16, which would overturn that ban. It comes amidst a nationwide conversation on race and social justice. But recent polls show the measure is struggling. Our colleague at KQED, Katie Orr, takes a look at why, so far, voters aren't making the connection.
The killing of George Floyd this past spring sparked protests across the country, including this one in Oakland. But amidst the marches and emotion, California lawmakers also saw an opportunity to overturn California's ban on affirmative action in public education, hiring, and contracting. Democratic Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, who chairs the Legislative Black Caucus, jumped at the chance, introducing a constitutional amendment to overturn the ban.
California's regressive ban on equal opportunity programs such as affirmative action denies women and people of color a level playing field in the workplace and in education.
But victory is far from a sure thing. Janelle Scott from UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Education says that's because Californians have gotten used to living with the ban for so long.
So I think it's a hard campaign to convince people that maybe some of our systems or processes are actually leaving people out through no fault of their own.
On the other hand, the recent college admission scandals demonstrate that some wealthy students get their own kind of preferential treatment. As Professor Scott notes, a recent state audit of the UC system singled out Berkeley for improperly admitting 42 students who were connected to the UC regents, major donors, or staff.
There's been a different kind of affirmative action in place for wealthy people, and really maybe some internal reckoning about people who have had access to preferential admissions through their wealth or political or social connection.
Gail Harriet is a law professor at the private University of San Diego and works with the No on 16 campaign. She says race should not be a factor in college admissions.
The standards can vary from school to school. You know, some schools may look for pure academic talent. Other schools may take into consideration athletic talent, entrepreneurial talent, leadership talent, all of these things. Just not race.
Backers of Prop 16 know they have a tough road ahead. Recent polls show two-thirds of likely voters are opposed or undecided. And with the presidential election, a pandemic, and 11 other statewide measures all fighting for attention, it will be difficult for supporters of affirmative action to break through with voters. In Sacramento, I'm Katie Orr.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. With just days to go in this election season, one key group has been drawing a lot of attention, Latinx voters. And their impact on elections is particularly important here in California, given that they make up the state's largest ethnic group. To learn more about efforts to appeal to this large, influential, and diverse population, I spoke with Dora Westerland, director of the Fresno Area Hispanic Foundation, Jesse Rojas, CEO of The Red Group, a business and political consulting firm in Bakersfield, Adriana Saldivar, Fresno-based program manager for the Latino Community Foundation, and Ivy Cargyle, assistant professor of political science at CSU Bakersfield. She started the conversation by discussing some of the misconceptions people have about Latinx voters.
It is still assumed that they are a monolith. And additionally, people just don't understand why there's this misconception about them being the sleeping giant. And the reality is that on that last point about them being the sleeping giant, they are, the Latino, Latina, Latinx community is a large community. And it is very much the case that approximately a million or so are turning 18 every year. So it's definitely a community that's growing, but the reality is that they still need to be mobilized. And I think that that's where we miss understanding why they don't engage with the political system and the political process. A lot of engagement is needed in terms of helping them understand how and where they fit into the political process. Thinking about the fact that they became way more active voters post-1965 and the Voting Rights Act. That's not a very long time between 65 and 2020 for us just to say, oh, well, they should all be voting. They should all be engaged. They should all care. They care, but they just, the reality is that there's still a lot of learning that needs to happen. So that's one misconception. And then the second misconception is that they are a monolith and that they're all going to vote in the same way and that there aren't any distinct nuances that exist within the community. It is very important to take into consideration that, for one, while there is this understanding that a lot of them are coming from an immigrant background, we have to remember that for some Latino, Latina, Latinxes, particularly those here in the Southwest, the border crossed them and not the other way around. So, you know, there's going to be distinctions in how these individuals view the political process and think about engagement with governmental actors. Now, there is a large portion of the community that is immigrant, but even within that, it's also important to consider the countries that they're coming from, because those are having an effect on how they are viewing political candidates here in the host country that they are now voting and participating in. So the entire community doesn't all see politics in the same way. They don't all perceive discrimination and threats in the same way as the media would like to paint it.
Dora Westerlin, given your work directing the Fresno Area Hispanic Foundation, do you have any more you'd like to say on this topic? You know, what do we get wrong when we talk about Latinx voters?
I do believe that, you know, the Latinos in our community, they still need the education part first and foremost, and they have to be mobilized and have some leaders that they look up to that they can connect with, not because just they just want them to vote a certain way, but because they want to educate our community. And I do believe that most of the politicians that want to get the Latino vote, they want to get it when they need their vote. And I do believe that at that time, it's too late. And as I see, the Latinos have been, I do believe, motivated to vote, but not in the quantities and in the way that we should be voting. And I do believe politicians need to get everyone to vote, you know, not just a certain part of the community, but specifically the Latino community needs to be educated. I do believe that politicians need to educate from the heart and not just to get the vote of the Latino community.
Adriana Saldivar, I understand that the Latino Community Foundation is working with a number of organizations to mobilize voters. Maybe you could weigh in on some of the things that Dora just said.
You know, in California, we have a very large voting bloc that is Latino. But when we look particularly in the Central Valley, Latinos are also a very young group. So some of the investments that we've made at the Latino Community Foundation, particularly to get out the vote in the Central Valley, is by relying in a lot of community organizations that are those trusted leaders and those groups that are out there making calls every day, engaging young people. And so we're proud to support organizations like 99 Roots in Merced County and Fresno County, who are doing incredible work and working specifically with young voters to turn them into habitual voters, right? We know that if young people vote for the first time when they're 18, they're likely to continue voting the rest of their lives. And when we look at Latinos in California, there's 7.9 million that are eligible voters, and half of that are under 35 years old. So we are looking at Gen Z and millennials who can really make a difference in this election. Farther south, we have Loud for Tomorrow, Southern Soul, and a couple of other groups that have really taken to heart the potential that we have to turn young people out to vote in numbers that we have never seen before. we noticed in 2018 that in the Central Valley, there was a huge uptake of voters that came out who were young, over 200% turnout. And so we're hoping that the efforts from our community partners will result in something similar this year. And we're starting to see the ballots come in, right? Just today, I saw a report that in Fresno County, over 160,000 ballots have been returned today. And compare that to 2016, after the final day of voting, we're ahead 30,000 votes. And I can't wait to see how many more Latinos will come out. But they're not coming out because nobody's talking to them. I think a lot of credit goes to our community organizers, to our advocates, who understand that justice, particularly racial justice, is in the ballot this year. And we want to make sure that everybody that is able and capable of voting does it this year.
So I do want to spend some more time unpacking this myth of the Latino-Latina voting population as a monolith. And Jesse Rojas, maybe you could help me unpack that. You know, there's been a misconception for a long time that this population of voters would just naturally lean to the left. But of course, data and polls indicate that that is not the case. Can you talk a little bit about some of the ideological diversity within the Latino-Latina voting community?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I do want to say I echo several of the foundational points that the other individuals mentioned. I think maybe from my professional standpoint and also as a citizen myself, I think I probably blame some of those challenges to a different side of the aisle, obviously. But I did want to mention briefly a little bit about my background. I was actually born in Mexico. I came to Delano, California when I was 11 years old when my parents, 99% of my family still lives in Colima, Mexico. Obviously, my name is not Jesse. My full name is so long that I believe on my ID it says continued on page 2. But my perspective, it's going to be a little bit from a professional standpoint as someone who, out of choice, ended up getting involved in politics about 8 years ago and worked on many political campaigns. But at the same time, as someone who's an immigrant, who's a first generation here, who knows what it is to be in the shadows, who had to battle through the complex immigration system and spend thousands of dollars with my parents to try to find a way to become a citizen. And I actually just became a citizen last year. This is my very first year, my first election that I was able to vote in the primary. And so, you know, I am very proud of that. But, you know, going back to that, I think fundamentally, especially in California, I believe when both parties, most candidates and politicians, when they refer to Latinos or Hispanic or whatever term you want to use, or now this new fast moving trend of Latinx, right? It's always about a new terminology, a new marketing word to try to refer to as Latinos and think that we're all the same. We're not. And, you know, I go back to how my grandparents and my great-grandparents raised us. I mean, obviously, at heart, from a social standpoint especially, we're very conservative. And you can see that in small communities like, you know, Delano, Kerman, Ridley, Avenal, I mean, you know, Arvin, Lamont, where, yeah, you know, there's a majority of Democrat registered voters. But when you start talking to them about social issues specifically, they lean very conservative. But the problem is that most candidates, and most of the times it's from both sides of the aisle, they don't spend a lot of time actually delivering the message in the right way to Latinos. Again, like someone mentioned, it is true. They only come around every 2 or 4 years trying to earn someone's vote, and then they leave. They don't keep talking to us. And obviously, it doesn't help out that in Spanish media, it's even more biased and less options than the English side of the media. So I also have gotten to see that there is a different political perspective from first and second generation Latino immigrants, Mexican immigrants, than the third, fourth, fifth generation. And in this case, as we're referring to the younger generations that are Latinos. Because why? People like myself, I got to be born in Mexico. I got to live in Mexico. I completely and clearly understand why we ran away from Mexico and why we came here and not Canada or not Europe or not any other country. So I can relate. I know how unions get in bed with politicians in Mexico. I see it with my family and my friends. I see the very same things that are happening here in our state legislature, and I can clearly compare it to what I saw and I live in Mexico. But you look at the newer generations, the younger generations, either being millennials or even the newer ones, they cannot truly compare it because they didn't live it over there. They know their parents or great-grandparents came here from over there, but they've lived here. They cannot compare and say, well, maybe that's wrong. Maybe I don't want the same thing that I ran away from in Mexico. But you go back to what you mentioned about the perception that most Latinos should vote Democrat or are leaning Democrat. It's obviously not true.
And we did see it with the Latino results in President Trump's first election 4 years ago. We saw it even during the Bush election. But when you go back to thinking of where Latinos stand when it comes to voting, I remember coming home from school during Obama's first election, and every single time I got home from school, my dad would be watching Univision, Jorge Ramos, Al Punto, all the time, every single afternoon, every single night. You know, my dad loved watching the news. He still does. And every single day he would say, mijo, you know, he's going to help us. He's actually going to give us immigration reform. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. And that went on for months and months and months. So, you know, as any young person, I wasn't involved in politics. I didn't know better. I just, you know, was just green. I didn't know anything. I was naive. And I thought, well, yeah, that's true. I should be Democrat. I should support Obama in 2008 because he's going to give us papers. He's for immigration reform. And then fast forward now, a few years later, I ended up getting a job just working in a political campaign. And then it went from there. I got to see the reality, the behind the doors conversations. And it completely opened my mind to how wrong I've been to just have that perception that I should be Democrat and that they're for us. The reality is when you look at, in this case, the left, most of the left people on the left candidates, they don't really care about it. They just use us, use an emotional issue that has deep meaning to us, but they won't actually take action because once they do take, if they did take action, they will not have a big political talking point to come to us every 2 or 4 years. And you saw, you know, something as simple as who built the cages and, you know, who's actually done more from a financial standpoint to a social standpoint for what Latinos' values actually are.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. You've just heard from Jesse Rojas, CEO of the Red Group. We're also talking with Ivy Cargile, Assistant Professor of Political Science at CSU Bakersfield, and Adriana Saldivar, Program Manager for the Latino Community Foundation. But I want to direct the next question to our fourth panelist, Dora Westerlund, Director for the Fresno Area Hispanic Foundation. You said earlier a comment that I think mirrors much of what Jesse was just talking about, which is that politicians are not actually talking to the Latino, Latina community in between election cycles. And I'm wondering what you would like to see change from politicians on both sides of the aisle.
So I do believe that we still have to do a lot on education. And I think it's leaders like the Community Latino Foundation and others that we have to step up and educate our community and letting them know that we are there, that these are, you know, these are the things that matter to us. These are the things, education for them. And it's not just, you know, coming to like, okay, I need your vote. Now I need, you know, you to step up and come out to vote. I still think that a lot of the politicians and a lot of the campaign managers, not all of them, but some of them, do a lot of advertising on the regular English channels, but they don't do a lot on the Spanish channels. So that's the other thing. You know, they know that, you know, they're like, well, you know, the Latinos are not going to go out to vote, so we're not going to spend our monies there. So we're going to spend them over here. So, and then the other part is that politicians, when they're running, and I know it because I was part of one campaign, and they would give you the precincts, and when they would give you the precincts, they're like, well, don't go here, don't go here. And they were all Latino voters, just go to propensity voters. So that means we are avoiding the Latino community, we're not getting to them, and we're just ignoring them. And now that the numbers are up, maybe, yes, they're up. But I don't think we have seen the true numbers of Latinos that can go out to vote. And that's why I believe there's got to be a mobilization, there's got to be leadership that starts right now for in next 4 years. Because we do need Latinos to go out to vote, and we have not seen those numbers until we mobilize them and we make sure that they go out to vote.
Adriana Saldivar, do you think this is going to be a watershed election when it comes to mobilization? If you could also talk a little bit about, this is a slightly different question, but in terms of your outreach efforts, you know, you're doing this in the middle of a pandemic. And often when we think about how groups connect with voters, it's that in-person canvassing touch point. And how are you doing that work in the middle of a pandemic?
Such good questions. I definitely think this year is going to be groundbreaking, not just for the Latino vote, but in general turnout. Out of everybody that can vote in California, 1 in 4 Latinos have already voted. 1.4 million ballots have come in from the state. So we're definitely in trend and moving in the right direction as far as getting out the vote.
I think this year has been challenging, right? We all know the pandemic has definitely thrown a wrench in our lives. When you talk to Latino voters and you ask them, what is the issue that you care about the most in this election cycle? The number one answer that we found in a recent poll we did was the Latinos, their top issue is COVID-19. The health impact that has had on Latinos has disproportionately affected this community. The economic landfall has also fallen on our essential workers who are putting their life at risk to pick our crops, to serve our industries. And so the pandemic and the way the pandemic is being handled is a top issue for Latinos. So we are hopeful that this issue will bring them out to vote in higher numbers. But that doesn't happen without direct engagement from voters. And I agree, you know, to what I heard before, that parties typically don't outreach and target Latino voters because they're seen as not the person that's likely to vote. So they go with the trusted people that have turned out in every election. What is so crucial about nonpartisan get out the vote efforts and nonprofits that we work with who are actively reaching out to our neighbors in our community is that they are actually reaching those people that are often forgotten by the parties, that are not being outreached by anybody else or by typical campaigns. So that is a crucial piece of the puzzle, right? Who reaches out to them? Is it somebody that reflects their values and somebody that speaks their language and somebody that they can talk about the things that worry their families the most? And I think a lot of the organizers who are out there getting out the vote right as we speak in this moment are usually Latinos and Latinos that understand where voters are coming from. You know, I think of my family. My family is 14 people and we are a mixed status family, meaning not everybody in my family is a citizen. We're an immigrant family as well, like Jesse. So we do have folks who are undocumented, folks who have their green cards, and folks who are citizens. And when I see my oldest brother vote, I take pride in that because I know he's voting not just for himself, but he's voting for an entire family. And what he's putting on the ballot is representative of what he cares about. And not just as an individual, but as a community, as the head of a family, as somebody that has struggled a lot in this country, but still remains hopeful that when we vote with our values, that when we vote for the people that really are going to represent and tackle those issues that we care about, that positive change can happen. And the other thing that I want to mention is like, yeah, what we see in the Valley and just in general is like around an election cycle, a lot of money comes into the Valley to pay for this campaign to make sure people are activated. But civic engagement needs to happen year-round. It's not a one-and-off process because people need to be engaged in things that happen all year-round. And that's why, again, as a foundation, where we take pride is in working with groups who are not just doing electoral work right now, but they're doing civic engagement work year-round and engaging the community in a variety of issues. Ways that we have continued to get out the vote, even through the pandemic, has been a lot of virtual work, right? We've had so many events over the last couple of weeks to energize people, and we do it safely distancing through the technology that we all now have access to. But also, I think this week, what we're really pushing is for people to do their own get out the vote efforts by texting their friends, texting their family, sharing why voting matters to them, why this year is crucial, and what they're hoping that their loved ones will do to be part of this democracy.
Before we wrap, I do want to give Ivy an opportunity to weigh in on how gender intersects with ethnic identity when it comes to voting behavior.
Part of the trends that we're seeing right now, and going back to the trends that we saw in 2016, there is definitely a gender gap, I think, in that respect. The Latino, Latina, Latinx community is, in fact, very similar to the broader white community in that we're seeing Latino, Latina, Latinx supporters for Trump. It is there, but if we look at the numbers, it tends to be more so the men that are supportive of Trump. I'm not saying that women don't support him. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that there are more men. And in terms of women, women are either supporting the Biden-Harris ticket or they're leaning in that direction more so than not. And that's exactly what we saw in 2016. So I think in that respect, looking at issues of immigration, looking at issues of reproductive rights, I think also thinking about the recent confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court, I think that matters. Part of the issue that is driving them, particularly with young Latinas, is this nomination to the Supreme Court because they're understanding that reproductive rights for women are on the line. The Affordable Health Care Act is also on the line. So young Latinas are actually paying attention to this. And so I'm really curious to see if, in fact, for some of these younger women, you know, these are the issues that are mattering to them. Something that we also need to think about in terms of this intersection of gender and ethnicity is also the effects of COVID and who's working on the front lines, right? I mean, if we're thinking about in the Central Valley, thinking about our farm workers, and thinking about, you know, how much PPE they have available to them, thinking about who is actually there to provide all of these services and how much protection we're able to provide for them to provide these services, these needed services, and all of the different things that we could be as a society having available to them, like affordable health care. And that's something that we don't have. I mean, if we look at generally nationwide, the Latinx group is the second largest group that is dying of COVID right now. And a lot of that has to do because they are essential workers. They're on the front lines. And going back to a point that was just made, some of our voters, at least in talking to some of my students are saying exactly what was just said, right? I live in a mixed status family and I'm not voting just for myself. I have to look at my parents. My parents are farm workers. I go out and we have a lot of our students at CSUB that are farm workers as well. And they're like, we're there. I'm looking at what is happening right now. And it's not just about what I want for me, but it's also what I want for my parents. I do want immigration reform. I don't want children in cages anymore. I do want to be able to, I do want to live in a better society. And so I think all of those things are in fact motivating a lot of Latinos and also too specifically Latina women.
There is so much to discuss here. I wish we had more time, but Ivy Cargill, Dora Westerland, Jesse Rojas, and Adriana Saldivar, thank you so much for your perspective.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for the invitation, and I look forward to continuing this discussion.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. With the election coming up next Tuesday, we wanted to delve into what brings voters to the polls. What do they want changed? What do they want candidates to address in their neighborhoods? Reporter Laura Satsui is here to tell us about an outreach project she led to find out what voters really want. Thanks for being here, Laura.
Thank you, Kathleen.
To start, what was this survey about? Why do it?
Well, to pull the curtain back a little bit about our process, we put out a survey that we called Valley Votes 2020 back in July. And it's based on this concept that a reporter named Jay Rosen formalized called the Citizens Agenda. And the idea is if you ask citizens and voters and residents, you know, what it is that they care about in their communities, even with regards to elections or really any issue, then ultimately your reporting can be more informed. It can be a little bit more like, well, we know people care about X, so let's look into X. And considering there is so much happening with the election, the pandemic, you know, we wanted to know what's on the minds of voters. And the survey had questions like, you know, what concerns do you have in your neighborhood? And it asked people to rank issues from most important to least. And of course, also asked folks for some demographic data like, what is your zip code and how old are you?
And after putting out the survey, what did you learn?
We got a lot of responses around COVID-19, not surprising, and what will be done, what candidates could do to restore the economy. People saying, you know, I'm really worried about small businesses in Fresno. Obviously, we know that's been top of mind. Nationwide, people have gone on unemployment. Some businesses have closed. People were also really concerned about homelessness and housing. Also social justice and law enforcement. You know, this summer we saw lots of demonstrations in opposition to police brutality, specifically against, you know, brown and black folks. I spoke to one listener who, as I said, listed homelessness as a big concern of his. His name is Danveer Singh. He's a listener in Bakersfield, and he helps run a small business with his family and is also an actor. Here's what he told me about folks he sees, you know, building encampments near his family's store.
You know, they get pushed aside very, very quickly, you know, with the security, but, you know, half of the people I'll see are either dealing with some type of mental distress, and the other half just can't keep a roof over their heads, which is becoming more difficult now than ever with the COVID-19 pandemic.
And he says he does what he can. He gives them water if they come by the store, but he ultimately sees people having to fend for themselves. I want to note the Bakersfield Kern Regional Homeless Collaborative did help open two new navigation centers to serve those who are housing insecure in Kern County this year, and has also doubled the number of available beds in shelters. So those are positive moves. But the county's point in time count, which tallies as many people experiencing homelessness as possible, that number has risen over the last 2 years as well. In January of this year, at least 1,580 people were counted, and that's nearly double those who were counted as homeless in 2018. They counted only 885 people. I want to say another thing that I found so interesting about talking to Danveer is he said he's not a citizen, so he can't vote. But he also feels pretty frustrated because other people in his life who can vote, he doesn't feel like they're really super invested or really very interested in doing so.
So in addition to homelessness, you mentioned social justice and COVID-19. That seems to make sense considering we're in a pandemic and there's been a lot of attention on police reform. Were there any other big issues that people named?
Yes, lots of concern around climate change and taking science seriously. Some of those responses do go back to COVID-19 and the handling of the pandemic on a local and federal level. One listener wrote in that two out of their three top questions they have for candidates are, quote, whether or not they will defy science on climate change and whether or not they will defy science on the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, this person said they were a Kings County resident, and they said that they've heard denials of science by their local officials that makes them feel pretty unsafe overall.
For the responders that you spoke to, are they taking these concerns with them to the ballot box?
It seems like it. I spoke to another person in Bakersfield named Nick Strobel about his answers. He had also listed housing and food insecurity as issues that he thinks need more attention. And so I asked him, you know, if housing and food security are not doing very well now, like, do you have any hope that they will improve?
We'll see what happens in November with the elections. I think if we have the current administration stays in, then it's going to get a lot worse.
But he also says even if there's a Biden win, he doesn't count on immediate change. I mean, ultimately, he said he wishes elected officials would keep this basic tenet in mind. Does their decision make more people hungry? Does this decision make more people lose their homes? Another thing he told me is he thinks it may very well be up to the younger generations that will make things better.
What gives me hope is that more of the millennials and folks that are like my daughter's age, they're right in college right now, and they seem to be, you know, I'd say more progressive in the sense of they're wanting to work together. They can see what all of us, you know, all of us jerks, all of us adults are just screwing their future up, and they're sort of pretty tired of that.
He also said he feels like the one thing his generation did right was raising their kids to have better values and then acting on them. And, you know, we've all heard the headlines that millennial and Gen Z adults are could make up a substantial share of eligible voters. The Pew Research Center projected that between those two generations, they could make up about 37% of the electorate. So I think one thing to watch is, are those voters going to turn out and what impact will they have? And I want to note, you know, Election Day is Tuesday, but we won't have certified results on election night. County registrars of voters have about a month to certify those results and send them to the Secretary of State. So while we're all really eager for answers about who wins and, you know, who turned out, we're just going to have to be a little bit patient.
Well, thanks for talking that through with us, Laura.
Thank you, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. It's the end of October, which means we're stuck with a pandemic Halloween. Rest assured that there are ways to celebrate safely if you can deal without trick-or-treating in groups or hosting that big costume party. Here with some tips for a safe Halloween is FM89 health reporter Carrie Klein as part of our weekly COVID-19 update. Welcome, Carrie.
Hello. Hi, Kathleen.
So as usual, let's begin with an overview of what happened with COVID-19 in the San Joaquin Valley in the last week.
Okay. Well, after many weeks of holding steady, it looks like newly reported cases are slowly ticking back up. It's not necessarily bad news just yet, but it's not good news either. And when it comes to deaths, deaths due to COVID-19 have not caught up yet. There has not been an appreciable rise, but there is typically a delay between rising case rates and rising fatalities. Now, when it comes to hospital beds, there's an interesting pattern here, which appears that the number of COVID-19 patients in regular hospital beds is not rising, but it is in ICU beds. So that's a peculiar trend here. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about the blueprint for a safer economy, this plan statewide for reopening businesses and houses of worship. No counties in our area fell back into more restrictive tiers, which is good news. That means that there are no additional business closures or restrictions this week. And so where that leaves us is that Madera and Tulare counties are in the purple most restrictive tier. Fresno, Kings, Kern, and Merced counties are a tier ahead in red. And then Mariposa is in the least restrictive tier, which is yellow.
So, of course, tomorrow is Halloween. Obviously, a big weekend for celebrating, mingling, and sharing food and lots of candy. Mm-hmm. But in light of the pandemic, is Halloween essentially canceled this year?
No, it doesn't have to be. I mean, it's not going to be the same experience this year. But, you know, as KQED put it in one of the stories that they wrote, there are ways to make the prospect of a pandemic Halloween suck a little bit less than you might think. And so, you know, a lot of keywords here are doing things at home, by car, and at a distance. You know, health officials are really discouraging trick-or-treating. And instead, they suggest things like, you know, gathering just with your family or only with a few households outside. You can go to an outdoor museum or display. There are drive-through things like haunted houses, movies, performances, you know, and there are even things like scavenger hunts, do something in your backyard or go around your neighborhood without actually involving other people in your neighborhood. You can do virtual costume parties, pumpkin carving contests. You can decorate cloth masks for Halloween. I mean, there are just endless possibilities like this. And, you know, you can keep an eye on places you usually like to visit. They may have online or drive-through events. Maybe you can even rent out a performer to come and do something fun outside your house. And one suggestion I keep hearing a lot is grab-and-go treats. And for more, here's Fresno County Interim Health Officer Dr. Race Fora.
Think about creating bags that you just pass out or leave out in your yard. And then people are getting really creative with zip lines, little chutes and slides for candy, hanging things on a tree or hanging things on a hat rack that they keep outside so that they don't have to actually interface at very close distance with kids that are wanting to celebrate the festival of the season.
And I should mention, it's not just Fresno County who is suggesting these things. I mean, it's public officials everywhere, county governments, public health departments, the CDC, it's sheriff's offices, all are urging everyone to be safe and not let your guard down.
But realistically, many people still will go out trick-or-treating. Is there a way to do that safely?
I mean, I think, you know, health experts will say that everything is risky in some way, but trick-or-treating is a much higher risk than doing things at home with your own household. Another thing to think about is that in the case of, you know, disease transmission on Halloween, you know, contact tracing could really be a mess. But if you are going out, you know, there are a lot of recommendations that say only go with people in your own household, stay a safe distance from others, don't crowd on doorsteps, wear cloth masks, not just plastic costume masks. They don't offer nearly the same protection. Avoid doorbells. You don't know how many fingers have touched them. And don't eat your candy while outside. Wait until you're home and you've washed your hands.
And then for those who do go trick-or-treating, do they need to disinfect the candy wrappers before they touch them?
You know, official guidance seems to say that surfaces really are not a common way that the disease is transmitted. It's really more through these droplets through the air, but it won't hurt anything as long as you're, you know, following the instructions for whatever disinfectant you're using.
Halloween, of course, isn't the only holiday that's coming up this weekend. What about safely celebrating Dia de los Muertos?
Right. This is the holiday that originated in Central America and Mexico. It's on November 1st. And it's a way of celebrating loved ones who have died. And I think the same sort of principles apply here. You know, the safest way to celebrate is do it at home, only with the people you live with. But there are some creative alternatives that I've read about. You know, create an altar to your loved ones in front of a window so others can see it from outside. Create a virtual altar, share it online or on social media. You know, if you're going to go to a cemetery, go only with your family members. Don't stay there a long time. Prepare your meals ahead of time or your food, hand it out without gathering, and then maybe host a small parade with everyone standing, you know, a wide distance apart.
So, Carrie, to a certain extent, I feel like people already know a lot of this. We've been hearing about masking and social distancing for months. It just seems like we're having to continually talk about these precautions just to keep people from letting down their guard.
Yeah, I think that that's right. And there's kind of a term for what we're fighting against, pandemic fatigue. Here's Fresno County's Dr. Ray Svora again.
The new scary monster that we do have to deal with right now is something called pandemic fatigue. And that is something that all of us are feeling, and that will really create a real nightmare scenario for us, is if we allow our apathy, our complacency, our sense of fatigue to overwhelm all of these really good preventative strategies that we have all been doing so well to abide by for the last few months.
And we are unfortunately seeing this play out in other parts of the country where case rates had been low but are now surging. And as county officials keep reminding us, in California, case numbers are tied to business reopenings. And so if we're careless, we're not just putting our communities at risk, we may also be leading to businesses and houses of worship needing to close back up and suffer more.
Well, let's end on a positive note. What are your plans for Halloween? Are you going to try any of these creative solutions?
Yeah, actually, I think we will. You know, this is going to be my daughter's first Halloween, so we're not going to miss out on the family photo op, I don't think.
But, I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, but I think what we'll do is that we're gonna put a table out by the street, we're going to put candy on it, let people take their own, and then we'll sit on our front porch and wave to everyone as they walk by. What are you going to do?
You know, it's going to be a typical Saturday night in the Shock household, which probably will involve a little Netflix and some takeout.
So that sounds exciting. Delightful. Get yourself some candy, too.
That goes without saying. Yeah. Well, I hope you and your family are all going to have a fun and safe time. And of course, we'll talk again next week.
Thank you. You too. Thanks so much.
And now it's time for another episode of StoryCorps San Joaquin. As part of Valley Public Radio's collaboration with the Personal History Project, we're airing segments based on recorded conversations from February 2020's mobile tour in Fresno and Bakersfield. Today we're going to hear from mother and daughter, Maria and Jasmine Leyva, as they trace their family's roots in El Salvador. They talk about Maria's childhood, the role food plays in their family, and the journey to building a new life in California.
I think something that really stands out for me is just, like, how different, like, the way that you grew up is from, like, the way that me and my sisters grew up. Can you tell me a little bit about where you were born?
I was born in El Salvador, in a small country in Central America, in the city of Chalatenango, like, in a small village called Guarila.
You know, you talk about how, like, you grew everything that you ate, and, like, it was pretty sustainable before sustainable was, like, a buzzword. So can you tell me, like, what a typical day was like?
Well, it was, like, we got up. Well, my mom would get up, like, at 4 in the morning to make coffee, or, like, sometimes toasted coffee and then grind and make coffee, fresh coffee. And for us, when the kids would get up to, like, we had chicken, we have, like, cow. And I would do a lot of chores before going to school. And sometimes I would even, like, eat something on the way there. But sometimes I didn't have time to eat. But we were, like, 8 people in the house, you know. And mothers back then, they knew how to stretch to feed everybody. My mom would have got up and like, cook the corn and make the masa to make tortillas. But most of the time we eat vegetables. Like, the main meal was lunch.
For me, I feel like food is such a big thing in our, like, relationship in our home. Like, even when you worked, like, you cooked a meal every single day.
I learned by looking at what she was doing, but, you know, we did a few things together. But then, like, when I moved to the city and I had to work, I learned from the other lady that I lived with, which was my guardian. So she cooked a lot, and she would have showed me.
We've talked about your mom before. What do you think, like, is something that you inherited from her?
This is hard. being a hard worker. And ways to feed everybody. And being like, there's in things that kind, I feel like, you know, to be kind.
Do you remember like how old you were when the war started?
Yeah, it started in 1979 and I was 15 then. And so I moved to the city, but I started seeing things like in towns, cleaning up the towns, you know, people leaving and stuff.
What was the most exciting thing about moving to LA as a young person in the 70s? Or was it, no,
80s? 80s. When I came here, I feel like I want to be free. I want to do whatever I want, you know. Then I met your dad, and with him, he gave me freedom. I mean, I didn't feel like he dictated or anything.
One of the coolest things is, like, the album, the photo albums we have, is I've noticed that, like, you guys dated. Like, you went on dates. Like, you have photos at Santa Monica.
Yeah.
You went to Six Flags. I think that's something that, you know, not till I was an adult could I recognize that, like, you were also young people.
Yeah.
Who had come from a really terrifying, you know, something really terrible. And then now you were young people in LA with other young people.
But at the same time, I feel like, wow, all the people had to die to be here, to have all the people have paid the way for me to be here. And sometimes I want to tell you guys, don't take it for granted, because a lot of people have to die in order for me to be here. I guess life goes like that, goes on. And you have to put it aside in order to enjoy what you have, because otherwise, if you keep thinking about that and feeling regrets and remorse, you can't live. You don't have a life.
You have three daughters. You know, like, what did you ever think that you were going to have three girls?
When I had you, it was kind of hard. It was different. I said, maybe just one, you know, or two. Yeah. No, I was glad that I had three daughters, you know.
What do you see, like, for our lives in the next, like, 10 to 15 years?
I feel like I'm, like, in a new state right now. Like, you guys growing up, and my immediate goals is, like, for Michelle and Heidi to finish school and be on their own and taking care of themselves. And for me, just to enjoy life, to enjoy, live a good life. I want to live until, I want to live until 100. But I want to stay, take care of myself. So I don't want to depend on other people, because all my life I've been taking care of myself. And but we'll see. We'll take it day by day.
Yeah.
Yeah, and enjoy it. Because you don't know tomorrow.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. And we'd love to hear from you, especially your experiences around the pandemic. Send us a voice memo on our app. Just hit the audience feedback icon and record. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, Carrie Klein, and Madi Bolaños. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.